The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm glad to be here. Lisa Tadeo is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Three Women, which was called a heartbreaking, gripping, astonishing masterpiece and won the Best Narrative Nonfiction Book of the Year at the British Book Awards, among other prizes. She is also the author of Animal, a novel about what happens when women are pushed beyond the brink and what comes after the reckoning. Her new book, Ghost Lover, is a collection of 9 stories, 2 of which were awarded Pushcart Prizes, about the obsessions, manias, and fevered desires inherent to love and sex in the digital age. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Hayden Dunbar, assistant editor of the Suwannee Review. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Thank you. Well, Lisa, I have a lot of questions for you. I'm super excited. But before we dive into Ghost Lover, I know you've been filming for the Showtime series for Three Women. Can you tell me a little bit what that process has been like, especially transitioning between writer and producer?
Yeah, it's been a lot. It's been exciting. It's one of the quickest educations I've had in anything. I haven't learned so much about another business in a very long time so quickly. It's funny that you should ask that, because that's exactly, I think that's really the hardest thing, is transitioning between the writing and the producing part. Because you know, it's kind of like with you know, promoting a book, and it's that similar thing where it's like you're going into this other part of yourself that is not necessarily the one that you think you're supposed to lead with. But what I will say about producing TV is I really don't, one of the things I miss about life with being a writer, maybe this is more of an answer than you bargained for, but one of the things I really miss is like getting stuff done. Like, cause sometimes writing, you'll have like writer's block, et cetera. There's something about like a job that doesn't involve creativity necessarily, but is more about like threading a bunch of needles to get, you know, a bunch of people to say yes to something. There's an excitement to that for me to like getting the person we need to get, to getting that actor, to getting that musician, et cetera. So I actually, it's really cool and fun, but to go back to your initial sort of question, switching between the two is definitely, it's frustrating that it has to happen like 7 flips a day, but otherwise yeah. It's cool.
I can imagine. So did your background in journalism come into play at all while writing Ghost Lover? Are any of these characters inspired by people you know or have interviewed before?
Yeah. You know, Grace Magorian, actually, who's the protagonist of a story about an older woman looking for love on the internet and sort of her backstory. I was interviewing someone for the book, for Three Women rather, sorry, many years ago. And she was the sort of house manager for a very wealthy family. And I got to go to her house and do the sort of, you know, kind of like watch her at work. And it was really interesting. And the dynamics of her relationship with her superiors was very strange for me. I hadn't really seen anything like that before. And the level of wealth was kind of just surpassed anything I'd also seen before. So it was a really interesting case study of what her like sort of work day was like. And then I also, a couple of years later, I met a woman who was close. This woman who I interviewed for the book was a younger woman. The woman that I met a few years later, who was a woman from Ireland, there was something that struck me about where she was from. I had been there. I was interested in her. We talked a little bit about her backstory, and I kind of created the character of Grace based on those two women. So that's kind of an example of two different, you know, somebody I met on a sort of friend level and somebody I met on an interviewing level that I kind of wove together into a character.
I studied abroad in Ireland, so I was very charmed by that aspect of Grace's character. You touched on wealth a little bit, and I think a lot of the stories in this collection highlight characters' affluence or lack thereof, especially professional or social statuses. How did you think about this in the scope of women's agency?
You know, when I was writing Three Women, one of the things that I was really struck by in Lena's story, who was a woman in rural Indiana whose husband had no longer wanted to touch her, kiss her on the mouth, and she started an affair with her high school sweetheart. One of the things that really struck me about Lena's story was that in Indiana, and with sort of the spousal, the marital laws, the way that they were, and moreover, not even that, but sort of Lena's access to a legal representation, her understanding of any of these things was so minimal that the economics of her desire were kind of thwarted by, like, there were economics having to do with her desire. And I found that very just... horrific. That on top of everything else that she had to deal with, she also couldn't really easily extricate herself. She didn't know what it meant for how she would take care of her kids going forward. And just the sort of the fear of that being a reason driving you to not do something you need to do for yourself was very poignant to me. Wealth in general, absence thereof, is interesting to me. In this country, it's such a thing that drives people, and it's such a marker, and it's such a way that we sort of like sector ourselves off, we create this like caste system out of it. So I'm always thinking about money. I think about money in regards to, like, just talking about Lena, and in other ways, and in a lot of my stories in Ghost Lover. One of the things that's very personal to me is I lost my parents in my early 20s, and I had the fortune of having their house, our family home, to sell. And I was able to live off of that for a little bit and not worry too much. And I think that that's something I think about all the time, that if I didn't have, I was so aggrieved by what happened and so sort of traumatized. If I didn't have that safety net of something to sort of, for me to hold on to while I was very young and going through like this awful pain, I don't know if I would have made it through. So I always think about that. I think about how, you know, how random life is and how, you know, terrible things can happen, but there's this sort of stabilizing force of money means so much. It means our level of care. It means whether or not someone lives or dies in a hospital. It's just so, I just think about it all the time and how unfair it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, some of what you just talked about, your own experiences, kind of, I feel like, can be seen from the story of Suburban Weekend, where Fern is selling her parents' house. I mean, did you draw on your own experience?
That one is very much my experience. Not so much, I mean, some of the friend stuff, but that was more about kind of, you know, just friendship in general and having, but for sure, Fern in Suburban Weekend is the closest to me in terms of the way that it felt, having this sort of like being a kind of like too young person in a suburban big house, you know, it's like a weird place to be. Like you're old enough to sort of live on your own, but you're also not. So it's like, it's super weird. Suburban Weekend's big and is a big personal one for me.
Yeah. I definitely glimpsed some of myself in that story as well. Many of your characters grapple with body image, restricting themselves through diets and exercise as a kind of self-punishment. How do you see this dynamic factoring into female desire?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to one of my friends the other day who was saying, like, she was like, you know, I think, and she was married, and she's like, I think I could just like take a lover or something. Like, I feel like I could just do that. And I was like, oh wow, that's so cool. I would need like 6 months. I would need like to get, like, I would need like, if I couldn't just be like, oh, I want to do something, you know, even if it had nothing to do with infidelity or hurting anybody I loved, I'm like, that there's no way. I would need like a runway for that. What we started talking about and what I find so interesting is that I think that there's so many women and people in general who are able to sort of to be intimate with other people and have really rich sex lives, regardless of how they sort, like they don't really count how they feel about themselves in their desire for desire. And I find that to be one of the most freeing, aspirational places to be in the world. I myself, if I don't feel like I'm like, if I'm not like in a place where I feel like I desire myself, I don't care who else does. And you know, I mean, I'm being super personal, but like, it's that to me is a really interesting, it's an interesting situation. And I know so many women who feel the same way. And then I know so many that feel the opposite way. And I just find the line between that and how we each got to our respective places to be so interesting. So I don't know that, you know, I don't have like an answer for what's what. I know that what side I would rather be on, and I know what side I am on. And I know, you know, what side a lot of people are on. And I think there's also this sort of like, you know, especially with younger generations, which I think is so remarkable. And it's something that myself, my generation and older generations don't really have the benefit of. I think there's this body positivity that is that younger generations are growing up with at the same time that there's like this just crushing social media, you know, what you're supposed to look like and be like. At the same time that there's that, there's also this like concurrent super positive energy going around that we did not have, that I, my generation certainly did not have. So I think that that's great. And I think we are learning so much from the younger generation about how to sort of, you know, about what just what matters and what doesn't, and where to look for, what to look for inside of yourself instead of outside of yourself, et cetera. But so much of that is still left over. And so much of that is still plaguing young women. It's not like, you know, everyone's just learned the secret to being perfectly happy with oneself. But I think talking about it is really interesting to me, and writing about it is really interesting, and writing about, I guess, the idea that we've been taught to have obsessions, and then we're taught that we're not allowed to care about them at the same time, which I always think is is kind of a not an unkind thing that we do.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting place to be. And I mean, that juxtaposition between like what we've grown up knowing and what we see on the internet. Mm-hmm. But I still think, yeah, I would pick my generations over.
Totally.
Ooh, not to keep taking us down this road, but in general, how do you approach writing about sex, or how does an awareness of physicality shape your writing overall? You often utilize bodily language in unexpected ways. I mean, some quotes just from this collection: his anger peed out of him. The whole nut of her was senseless as a toenail. Is centering these bodily images intentional?
Yeah, you know, when it comes to writing about sex, I am very, like, there are words that I just cannot abide by, not in other people's writing, just in my own. Like, I can't write certain words. I'm just like that. Not because it's like gross or I'm squeamish, but I feel like sex writing, I know that, everyone knows that sex writing can be incredibly cheesy, right? And it can be really, it can just feel, you can just start to get the sense of like the writer's discomfort sometimes, or sometimes there's a great amount of comfort, but the comfort is almost too overwrought. So I think there's like a really, there's a fine line. There's also a line between being, using sort of medical institutional terminology and then more like, you know, street terminology. And I don't like either sort of extreme. I prefer for my own writing to be somewhat in the middle, to almost be divorced from it in a sense, like to sort of write about the movement of bodies, and to write about other sensations that are taking place in the people's brain. At the same time, I do want it to be sexy, but more than sexy is I want it to be true and to feel real. So that's, but I think about it a lot. I mean, I think I give it a lot of thought, and I think, yeah, I give it a lot of thought.
No, I think you absolutely crush the authenticity in those moments. It's excellent. I particularly enjoyed the story Beautiful People. I may be a bit biased, as that's the story in the collection that the Swanee Review published.
That's one of my favorites.
It's incredible. And the story's ekphrastic qualities are particularly wonderful. Can I ask what led you to choose the painting The Welcome?
What led me to choose the painting, The Welcome? I love that painting. I saw it in someone's house, not like a print of it, I'm assuming, many years ago. And I remember asking, this was before I kind of knew anything. I mean, I still don't know anything about art at all, but it just stuck in my head. I just love the sort of the way that the woman is portrayed in that painting. And I'm actually like trying to see it in my head. She's kind of like exactly the desire we were just talking about, where she doesn't, like, nobody really cares in that painting. They all just seem to be having a good time or caring about a summer day in a way that I feel like is so, feels so sentimentally like the 60s or the 70s or some era that I was not a part of, that I feel like my parents were a part of. So something about that has always stuck in my head as something I wanted to like write about, that carelessness.
No, it's a beautiful painting, and I think just a really neat image that you pick up on. Going back to desire, there's a lot of longing going on in this collection, and few of your stories totally resolve it. How do you write about yearning without a total sense of despair? Or follow up, do you see Ghost Lover as a sad book?
Do I see it as a sad book? I tend to write sad books, I guess. I tend to write sad stories. I tend to have a sad worldview because of my sort of, one, my life experience. Two, I think I'm just, I was raised by a mother who was kind of a very depressive personality, who was also great fun and cool, but she would often say, I'm depressed. That would be like the start of the day would be, I'm depressed. And I'd be like, oh shit, where do we go from here? So I think that, so to answer your question, yes, I think The Ghost Lover, it can be a sad book, but I really, my goal when I write sad characters or when I tell sad stories, my goal is to sort of speak to the other sad people out there who have experienced difficult things and write from a place that makes them feel less alone. Not to sound like overly philanthropic, but that is one of that's one of the reasons I write the stuff that I do, is that when I was you know, when I had lost my parents, when I lost a lot of things, I've, you know, been through my share of trauma, just like many people out there, and when I was in those periods of loss or panic or pain, I really just wanted to feel less alone. And I just like, just was constantly looking for books that made me feel less alone. And I remember reading the Year of Magical Thinking by Didion. And there was just the way that she described the death of her husband and how like she just, you know, the idea of leaving his slippers by the bed was something I had done with my father's slippers. You know, the idea of if you take the slippers away, the person won't come back. I didn't think I was unique in sort of feeling that way necessarily, but I also had not spoken to another person who could articulate it the way that, you know, someone like Joan Didion can. And so that is a lot of the goal in a book like Ghost Lover and in Animal, frankly. The idea is like, you know, I know intense sadness. Let me tell you what mine looked like, kind of a thing.
There's something very powerful about an author being able to see you in that way. And I think you do that for a lot of people, and that's incredible.
Thank you.
When thinking about feminine desire, how do you write about sexual liberation versus exploitation? How one informs the other? You seem to have a very balanced approach to this, I'd say.
You know, I do, I feel like I do, a balance is one of my, it's something I care a lot about, is balance. And I think that balance is really important in writing. The balance of liberation versus exploitation, I think that if we draw too thick a line between those things, that we start to make rules for ourselves that we don't even necessarily want to follow, I guess. I always feel like there's a middle ground to life that can be approached in a way that, you know, isn't so hard and fast. I think, you know, like when people talk about murder of women on television and in film and movies, when people say we shouldn't be watching that, it's like, well, it's still happening. So not watching it, not seeing it is not exactly the answer. You know, not talking about someone's pains and triggers is not the answer to the pains and triggers never happening again.
Absolutely. In my reading of Ghost Lover, there are absolutely twin threads running through many of these stories. For example, Air Supply and American Girl both depict women considering their frustration with the phrase, feel like. Are there other moments that you see as linking these stories, or what do you view as the connection point across them?
Like feel, you know, it's funny. I guess someone said of my writing that sometimes it seems like I'm speaking in code to like certain women, and I really liked that. And not that it's certain women that I'm speaking to, but maybe it is. I think that, you know, sometimes I'll sit, I use feel like all the time, right? But, and I'll like sort of self monitor myself doing it and go, I can't believe I just did that. I feel like, but I also perfectly understand, you know, that not liking of that in myself and thinking about someone else thinking that about me is often how I write. Like when I'm at my most sort of cutting, I think it's the way that I imagine someone else saying the worst thing they can say to me, if that makes sense. And that's kind of a place that I write from.
One of the things that charmed me most about this collection was the honesty with which you write female friendship. Was it difficult for you to be so explicit about the ways competition and performance can percolate even our closest friendships as women?
Yeah, it's like a really kind of squeamish thing to do, because it's like, in some, especially as I've gotten older, my relationships with women, friendships with women have become so much more interesting and important to me, not than my relationships with men, but like, they just, I mean, with not, you know, not like relationship with my husband versus men. I don't mean like women versus men. It's just that female friendships have just deepened so much. And I think there's a complexity that happens with them that just, they just change over time as we age and get into different sort of life moments. And I think that, you know, when you're sort of single with a group of girlfriends or one really close friend, so much can make it feel, so much can make it feel like a scary thing, because you're so close and you're so understanding of one another that even talking about it kind of feels like a betrayal, if that makes sense.
Totally. I don't want to ask you to choose favorites, but was there a story from this collection that you most enjoyed writing?
Oh gosh. I mean, I'm not just saying this because you are an editor at the Sewanee Review, and because it's one of the best literary magazines ever, and certainly under Adam Ross's helm. It's just amazing. That being said, I do think Beautiful People was my favorite to write. It was fun to write it, and I actually wrote it. It's in the movie industry, and I actually wrote it before I myself worked in the TV and film industry. And so, and I was asking, you know, several people at the time as I was writing it for advice and help on how to, on how to make sure I got all the things right. So it was fun because I was kind of so taken with the world, and now that I'm sort of in the world more, I feel like it would have been less fun to write it now. So I'm excited that I wrote it when I did. And I also just, it's about a particular kind of obsession, that I think is really exciting. I think that, you know, the obsessions that we have for people that we've only met once or twice can be so feral and exciting and so difficult to explain to other people and to validate. So I think that they can be the most exciting because, you know, not validating it, not getting it validated by other people means you kind of have to keep it to yourself how much it means.
It's wild how much Jane's perspective is balanced between fun but devastating. Like she's so wild in this fixation, but you can't look away. You can't look away. How has publishing a short story collection been different from your previous books?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, it's hard because Animal was published during sort of the height of the pandemic. So, you know, it was definitely a difference already from publishing nonfiction. Short stories, it hasn't, I mean, I don't know. It just kind of came out, so I'm kind of I guess. I mean, I'm really excited about it because I probably like talking about short stories more than I like talking about anything else, which is why, you know, publishing and lit mags and doing all that is such a it's just such a big part of my whole life from when I was a kid. So to have a collection of stories out is definitely something that I feel very proud of and excited. Bye.
And it's a lovely collection.
Thank
Okay, I think we're going to transition a bit to doing the Q&A portion. So if you haven't submitted a question already and you have something to ask, please feel free. I have one already here that I'm going to go ahead and start off with. So this person wants to know how we don't want to love someone who loves us until we finally do. Thinking about that relationship with characters like Joan or Cremora. And they're wondering where you think this comes from. Why do so many of us feel this way? It can't just be that we don't think we're worth loving, can it?
I don't think it's about not thinking we're worth loving. I think that sometimes, I think that sometimes we want something, we like the idea. I think we all like the thrill of the chase a little bit. Like we talk about that, you know, with men and stuff, but I think women are actually more excited by it in a sort of, you know, I wouldn't say I don't know the statistics on it, but from my sort of, you know, research in Three Women and all that, there's something about women wanting something they can't have, and it's something Esther Perel has talked about a lot too. I don't know the science of it exactly, but the notion that once women, we always think about men being, you know, the ones who are unfaithful and stuff like that. But really, when women are feeling safe in their marriages, relationships, whether it's the same sex or opposite sex, or you know, it's that sense of safety makes us less excited. And more apt to look for that sort of fear somewhere else. I think, not I think, I know this, you know, from science that we like that. We like the thrill of not knowing if we're going to get something, and our stability can sometimes make us feel static. So I think that that's I and then that's how I felt about Lena, the woman in Indiana and Three Women who wanted this man who wanted this affair with this man so much that she was willing to risk so much for it. The idea of wanting something so badly and kind of just going after it, I think is so, it's such an interesting, and whether it's right or wrong or moral or amoral, it's such an interesting thing to sort of address and write about. So for me, that's something that really, that I like writing in a character is this kind of like this desire for an unrequited love, I think is one of the most just, I mean, like I grew up reading, you know, those stories. I grew up reading Madame Bovary, like, you know, just all that sort of old romance stuff to interpolate that with modern love and the kind of hellscape of social media and all that, I think that marrying those two things can be really fun. So that's really where it comes from. I don't think it's so much on my part a feeling that these women feel like they can't be loved so much as they are looking for this ultimate thing. And the idea that they'll never get it is the most exciting idea of all.
So feel free to continue submitting questions, but we have another one here. Would you talk a bit about ordering the stories and the intention of the arc as they appear in the collection?
My editor, Jophie Ferrari Adler, Avid Reader at Simon & Schuster, he sent me an email that was like, you know, I don't really have any dog in this race when, you know, he does. I don't really have any dog in this race and I don't really know. This could just kind of be offhanded, whatever. But if it were me, I would go do, 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 do. And he's like, but, you know, like I said, it's just off the top of my head. And, you know, and I looked at it and I was like, that is, and he had given his reasons for how he ordered it and why starting with something that, you know, was like exciting and shot. And he did have an arc, and there was also a method of separating the characters by their ages. So there was sort of, you know, more of a, the point is I had nothing to do with it. So I'll take credit for it if people think it's good. And I'll also say it's my fault if it's bad, but it's really all my editor. And I actually think he did a brilliant job.
Yeah, I think they align so perfectly. And that's one of the most fun jobs with the review is placing the pieces in order and kind of the logic there. So
that's so
cool. I totally love that.
That's so cool that you guys get to do that like that often.
So fun. Okay, so we're still letting some more people, I think, submit questions, but I, of course, have another one. The title story's protagonist manages a service that helps desperate texters craft the perfect message to a crush. First of all, I want to say that I can totally see the technology here becoming something real that is released on the coattails of this book. but I have to ask, how did you come up with this idea? And do you consider yourself a good texter?
Wow, those are such great questions, Hayden. So I came up with the idea. I mean, when I was in my 20s and single in New York, I'd be like with my friends and we'd be like, here, just take my phone, just take it for the night. Just like, don't write to him, don't write to her, whatever, just do whatever, just like take it away. You know, I always thought about that. And I did a lot of, like Lena in Indiana would ask me to help her with stuff. And it was just the idea of realizing that once you remove your emotion from it, if you just go to help somebody else on something, it's so cleansing to just have clarity and to be like, no, if you want this person to do this, this is what you should do. And not letting them, because that's the issue with, like, you know, if you give your friends your phone at like midnight after like, you know, three drinks, they're like, just give it back. So the idea with this was that you couldn't do that, and or you wouldn't do it because you were paying, right? And you're paying a good amount of money. So it's like, you know, if I prepay for a workout class, I'm going to probably go. Whereas if I don't, I'm going to be like, oh, I'll just get it tomorrow. So that was kind of the idea, this sort of like forced abnegation of your ability to mess up for yourself in a sense. And do I think I'm myself as a good texter? Yeah, I do. I do think of myself as a good texter. I really do.
I believe you.
Thank you.
So we have another question from the audience. Can you comment on responsible questioning and getting women to open up to you as a confidant and listening as you're composing characters?
Yeah. I mean, for me, with three women, with other stories and things that I've done, I really am, it's, I spent many years thinking that I was a really bad reporter, interviewer, et cetera, because I wouldn't sort of ask the quote unquote tough questions. And I don't mean like when I did political stories and stuff like that, but when I was talking to, you know, women for Three Women, when I was talking to people for other stories where the people weren't public figures, I would feel like not okay asking them something if I hadn't either told them the answer to that question. And for me, if I hadn't given something back, I didn't feel comfortable taking it. And I also constantly was in question, called into question anything I could do that would affect someone's trajectory that I was writing about in a way that was not good for their lives and like, but it was good for a story. Strict line, not even, I don't know out of what. It's just like, I find it so disgusting to profit in any way from another human being's sort of world or life. But you kind of are put in that position as a writer sometimes. And it's ugly to me. So it's something that I'm very careful about how and what I would write about after hearing from someone. I think with everybody, what I do first is make a genuine human connection. And then hopefully the communication is a two-way street and the person always wants to be involved in it and is consistently making that decision for themselves on a daily basis.
Awesome. Someone would like to know more about your new series on Showtime. Apart from producing, what are you doing? And also, in terms of producing, what does that mean? Tell us about the writer's room, the stars, ..
That's so cool. So that's so funny. It's so funny because like the word producing and producer and all that, I didn't know what it meant. I still kind of don't. I know what it means for me is that, like, you know, figuring out who, you know, like getting together a crew of people, a casting team, a musical team, a cast, a soup to nuts sort of like hiring people to be a part of making this show. Our writer's room was really small. We just had a couple of women. It was myself, Laura Eason, the showrunner, Tori Sampson, Shisa Hutchinson, and my husband, Jackson Waite, was also in it when it was an okay, non-too personal woman day. But he helped me conceive of sort of the whole, you know, the series and how it would come into being. So our writer's room was during the pandemic and it was virtual and it was really, it was great. It was not quiet in the sense that, you know, it was, we were loud, but it was a nice, very gentle experience. And then production, we got pretty early on, Betty Gilpin signed on to play Lena. DeWanda Wise signed on to play Sloan. Gabrielle Creevy is playing Maggie. And my favorite in terms of what producing means, I guess, one of the people I really wanted on the show was Blair Underwood to play Richard, Sloan's husband. It was like the thing that I felt like I had to have because I love him as an actor and I thought that he was absolutely perfect for the role. And, you know, he was doing LA Law and had a couple of other things. Everybody was like, he's unavailable. And I was like, can I just get a quick call on the books with him? I just want to see if, you know, and myself and the showrunner had a call with him and kind of convinced him to do it. So that was kind of
my, like, I'm just like, oh, cool, I can do that. I got Claire Underwood to sign up to do this. And now I made all these promises I hope I can deliver on. But it's been a really cool process, and we are done with filming, and we are in the sort of cutting the episodes phase, and all that. And it's been really rewarding and exciting.
I can't wait to see it when it comes out.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again to everyone for coming. And thank you so much, Lisa, for being here. This has just been wonderful. I've loved the chance to pick your brain. And I know everyone here feels the same. So
thank you so much, Kate. And can everyone here please sign up, subscribe to the best literary magazine ever, the Sewanee Review, where Hayden works magic. And it is really, truly, it's my favorite place.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.